Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I'm Diana Isaacs, joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. We are still at ADA Scientific Sessions in sunny and hot Orlando, Florida, and we have a very special guest with us. We have Anastasia Albanese O'Neill from Breakthrough T1D, formerly JDRF. So we've done a lot of work with you over the years. We're very excited to have you. And if you wouldn't mind just providing a little bit of background on your role to our audience.
Absolutely. So I've been at Breakthrough T1D, formerly JDRF, 2.5 years. My official title is Associate Vice President of Community Screening and Clinical Trial Education. And my work is directly related to our mission, which is delaying and ultimately preventing type 1 diabetes and assisting with research that moves us closer to cures.
That is awesome. That is wonderful. So can you talk a little bit about why the name change? Where did it come from? Why this name?
Yeah, no, great question. And I know I was probably a shock for a lot of people that an organization that's only over 50 years old changed its name, but the name change was very important. And here are the reasons why. And I've been, I'll just say, backing up, I've been around formerly JDRF over 20 years myself as a volunteer before I worked at the organization. And since I've been involved as a volunteer, the name has changed 4 times. And the first 3 times were really a variation on the initials J, D, and F. So it used to be the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. Then when the focus became funding research for cures, it went to Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. But then you all remember, juvenile diabetes in the medical literature went away. And the clinical guidelines went away. Why? Because we know that people are diagnosed as adults. So it's not a diagnosis that only happens in childhood. At that time, the organization made it an acronym, JDRF, but people still said juvenile. And the truth is, type 1 diabetes is not just for juveniles. So it was time to make the name more inclusive and make sure, in doing so, making sure that people thought about that adult diagnosis. Because what happens to adults? They're misdiagnosed.
Absolutely.
About 40% of the time.
Right.
People are not thinking about type 1 when an adult comes through the door. So again, broadening really, I think, making a more inviting welcome mat to not just families of young children, but adults. And then acknowledging that the organization has funded some pretty cool breakthroughs over the year, including contributing to CGM, automated insulin delivery, and the first disease-modifying therapy that delays the onset of type 1 diabetes.
And I think that's important. So people with type 1 are living longer. That was one of the things that was reported out at ADA, and we see it in clinical practice. And, you know, The Breakthrough T1D has done research not just in delaying, preventing, but also a lot of research in the treatment of the complications that people develop over time with type 1.
Absolutely.
Can you touch a little bit on that? Just in a, what other, like, I know, I remember as a clinician, retinopathy specifically, that there was a lot of research that JDRF has done. I mean, even the first AID systems, a lot of that research was funded by. So, and yesterday you and I were in a session, you're like, how we fund that, right? And I was like, yes, of course we funded that. Even before doing all these things. So I think it also helps include, we're not just looking at this from your child was diagnosed with type 1 this week perspective, but also how do we allow these people that develop type 1, how do we stop it? How do we delay it? How do we stop it? But also the people that have it right now need help too.
Yes.
And that's where I think the Breakthrough T1D name change has really made a difference.
It's huge. Let me talk about some of those breakthroughs. So we've got the cures therapies, right? So ultimately, we want people to walk away from type 1 diabetes. We want a world without type 1 diabetes. So that would be a cell therapy that's still a treatment, or prevention, which means no one in the future is diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. But let's move over to improving lives. So you can look back at continuous glucose monitors, the New England Journal of Medicine manuscript. You can look at the JDRF, what it was called, JDRF writing group on CGMs. These were published in the early aughts, and that's what drove that technology forward. Automated insulin delivery, well known for the roadmap, and we're still sort of finalizing the pieces of that roadmap, right, around fully closing the loop. What we're funding now is it's still hard to eat with an automated insulin delivery system and exercise. So how do we fix those pieces of the algorithm? But that early foundational work was funded through our organization. And then complications are really important. We've got funding in kidney disease, in cardiometabolic health. That is an entirely separate portfolio that people may not even be aware of. Adjunctive therapies like GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors. We're funding studies there to get an indication for type 1 diabetes because we know there's a lot of benefit for those drugs. And then finally, type 1 takes up a lot of headspace if you're living with it. And so our psychosocial, we just are funding studies in that space to look at diabetes distress, depression, and disordered eating. So it really is any age, any stage, living well or cures. We've had breakthroughs in all of the places.
It's amazing. It really is to look back at the history.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So yeah, it's great. And it's an exciting time. I mean, I think, you know, you do interviews all day long, but the past 10 years in diabetes care, I've been
absolutely restored. Mind-boggling changes, right? Where we used to go, okay, there's no updates. This was interesting. Exercise more, eat more appropriately, you know, add vegetables to every meal, you know, those kinds of things, reduce your carbs or spread them out or do whatever. But now it's like, wow, what do we can add this, we can do that. We're really making huge gains in what we understand about the disease as well.
Yes. Yeah. Right. There's a saying I like to say, there are decades when weeks happen and there are weeks when decades happen. And we're in that latter sort of accelerated growth period. And, we heard at this conference about AI and how is that going to change our ability to do research and clinical care. So there's a lot coming. Change is sometimes uncomfortable. Name changes are uncomfortable, but again, we think the new name reflects where we are.
It's so great. We actually, the day you announced it, we did a podcast saying, we're so excited.
It's right. I'm going to listen to you to
talking to you about that. Let's change gears just a little bit.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about, we're at ADA, sunny, hot, humid Orlando. And can we talk a little bit about what Breakthrough T1D has presented at this meeting or funded at this meeting, but also what you're most excited about through your organization?
Yeah, so we could spend the rest of the day.
Yeah,
because there are hundreds of presentations that were funded by Breakthrough T1D at this conference, ranging from
that's incredible, right? I think we don't realize that. I don't think we realize, any of us, how much that Breakthrough T1D has given to different organizations and different companies and different schools, right?
Yeah.
Medical schools and hospital systems to do this research.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's literally over 100 either posters or oral presentations or portions of symposia. So it's across the board. It's everything from what we just talked about. It's psychosocial portfolio, improving lives portfolio, got things on screening. We've got things on disease modifying therapies, on cell therapies. What I'm going to focus on is a really exciting project that we've been working on with the International Community of Experts for 19 months, and that's the consensus monitoring guidance. One of the places where type 1 diabetes care is accelerating is detecting people early.
Right.
And in the guidance to date, we have not had any actionable clinical advice about what to do with individuals who have autoantibodies but don't yet require insulin, or in what we now call, it's new, early stage type 1 diabetes. It may be the first time some people are hearing it.
Yeah.
So it's now a clinical diagnosis is what we call stage 3 type 1 diabetes. We have got earlier stages, stage 1 and stage 2. We can pick people up there with a simple blood test by identifying autoantibodies, so antibodies to self, destroying those beta cells or insulin producing cells in the pancreas. So, but there was nothing to say what a person in clinic, a nurse practitioner, a doctor, whoever, what do I do with this person? How often do I monitor? Because we know they're going to progress.
Right.
What is that plan of care? And now we have not only a consensus, but an international consensus on what to do next.
So I think if we take one step back, we know that there are 5 autoantibodies, right? And if 2 or more of them are positive, that there is 100% chance or approaching 100% chance lifetime risk of developing type 1 diabetes.
Yep.
So that's what you're talking about. Like, these antibodies are coming back positive and you go, now what?
Yes.
So often, what do I do? Or one antibody, Eva, so can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah. And in some populations, you know, very young children with a single autoantibody do progress.
Yes.
Especially if they're under the age of 3.
Right.
And what I will tell you, you know, there's some very real stories that prompted this guidance. I can tell you, I travel a lot and I talk to a lot of people in the type 1 diabetes community. I'll just share one. I met this gentleman named Josh at our summit out west. And he was 38 at the time I met him. He was diagnosed at 37, but it didn't come out of the blue. He had participated in TrialMed. He had participated in the oral insulin study, and then he'd been lost to follow-up. And his primary care doctor, his primary care doctor, the study ended and he moved on, right? And he moved.
Oh.
Well, a number of years after that, he had all of the symptoms, but didn't think about it because he was living his life, as we all do, and ended up in DKA with a very high A1C over 14%.
Oh.
And so it's for Josh that this guidance is in place. We've had almost 1 million people, or approaching 1 million people, screened all over the world in research programs. Many of them have positive autoantibodies. People need to know what to do next. And in my training as a nurse practitioner, I would never order a lab if I didn't know what the plan of care was going to
be. If it was positive, negative,
right. Why would I do that? And what is the evidence for doing those things?
Right.
Now it's written down for people to follow, for kids, for adults, for pregnant women, all of those things. That is very, very important to realize the benefits of screening.
So who should we be screening?
Yeah. So the screening, so this guidance is around the monitoring. I think the science of screening is probably still unsettled. But what I can say is if you are a first degree relative of a person with type 1 diabetes, you have a 15-fold risk of progressing or of being diagnosed with stage 3 type 1 diabetes, 15-fold. And we have screened in research in the United States about 250,000 people. I think we're about to hit sort of a milestone. If you think about the population of about 2 million people with type 1 diabetes, they've got to at least have two parents.
Right.
They have siblings and then they have kids of their own. So there's probably at a minimum 5 million people who are first degree relatives who are screened.
Right.
And then also the research in TrialNet, you can screen second degree relatives, ages 2 to 20. So grandparents, cousins, nieces, nephews, grandkids. So, and there's a free pathway to do that. So that probably adds another 10 million people
where
you could screen. That's a great place to start.
Right.
That's a great place to start.
Yeah.
Sorry. And then really in...
Right.
No, that's right.
And then, as we know, autoantibody diseases run together. Autoimmune diseases run together. So we are in our practice, if you've got Hashimoto's, you have an increased risk. If you've got celiac, you have an increased risk. So, those other autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid, psoriasis, those kinds of things, increase your chances of developing type 1 diabetes. So why wouldn't we say, this is an option. Don't go tomorrow, but go. Put this in the next time you get labs, because all of those chronic diseases have lab work. And so we can do that without a whole lot of, no extra stick, no extra, you can always use TrialNet. You can also do private labs. You can choose how you're going to get it done. But why wouldn't we, right?
Well, and I think what's really important to that point is, especially if you have someone who comes in and presents with diabetes, with hyperglycemia,
yes,
and they have a history of one of those conditions that you just mentioned.
Right.
And for some reason, you have in your clinical diagnosis classified them as type 2 diabetes and they're not responding to therapy, that's when you're going to get those autoantibodies.
Absolutely. We do that in adult endo all the time.
Right. Yeah, as you should, but it doesn't always happen. And in fact, 40% of adults are misdiagnosed for the reasons we talked about earlier, but also not seeing that, not taking that really, and I think, look, clinicians are busy.
Mm-hmm.
Clinical time is compressed, but I think what you have flagged for people is if there's a history of autoimmunity and you've got a diabetes diagnosis, you really need to think about getting autoantibodies and classify that person accurately so they get the care they need.
Right.
Super important.
And very important. Absolutely. So these autoantibodies are positive now.
Yep.
And these guidelines are going to come out that a group consensus, and so consensus, I think international consensus, even U.S. consensus, we've all been in those kinds of meetings at some level in our careers, are hard.
They are hard.
Because people have all these different opinions. Tell us about where we are. What did you, and we don't need to go through it. Like, what do you do for a six-year-old with one positive or two negative, whatever.
Yeah.
But just in general.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about the screening, following what we do? What do we do?
Absolutely. So very high level.
Yep.
What's new? There was a guideline, and I want to give credit to ISPAD because they did have a guideline for children and adolescents.
Yes.
What was unclear in that guideline is how often to do it, how to do it exactly, and some other components that I'll talk about that were considered in that 2022 publication. But it's excellent, and that was really foundational for us in getting started. So this new guidance talks about what do you do with a child who's autoantibody positive, including single autoantibody positive? Because those folks aren't on the staging criteria. But again, I mentioned a lot of kids under 3 progress. We also see people of color progress with a single autoantibody and some adults. So we need to think about in kids, single autoantibodies and multiple autoantibodies. So that's really important. It also talks about the evidence for what monitoring modality should be used in kids and adults. So that's very important, and the level of evidence. We reached consensus on a few things. We couldn't reach consensus on continuous glucose monitors, but a great thing about being at Breakthrough T1D is we took that gap back and put out an RFA to fund research to get some evidence for whether or not that's a modality we can support or not.
So, right, absolutely.
Exactly.
So we need more data to know.
Yes.
We can't just write guidelines on correct. What I think or what you think. We need to have true science behind it. I love that.
Yes. So that was great. The other piece was adults. For the first time, we have guidance on what to do with adults. So I'll take us back. We talked about Josh, 37. He was initially identified as a teenager, but grew up to be an adult who was autoantibody positive, should be followed. People can remain autoantibody positive for a number of years without progressing. They become adults. We need recommendations of adult care. The evidence is thinner, but it's there. So it's very important. The other two components that I think I'm especially proud of is education. How to educate people, what topics to talk about, the cadence. And we've also identified the gaps. We need to learn more about education. And then finally, mental health, psychosocial interaction with being autoantibody positive. Most people who screen, 95% of family members, 99% of people in the general population will come back negative. Right. No autoantibodies.
I think that's very reassuring to maybe be encouraged screening.
Absolutely. Most of the time, if somebody's 99%, you're about 99% likely of winning $2 billion. You'd be
really out of breath. That's truly great.
So we can
read those people that are very afraid of the diagnosis. I'm afraid that if I get type 1, my sister could do it, but there's no way I could ever do that.
Yeah.
Well, you do because you have to, right? There's that behavior change of, no, what you're saying to me is, you don't want to even think about it because it's overwhelming to you. But if you get the disease, you will learn to do it because that's what happened.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's that. But there's also this, it's coming. Mm-hmm. And that's that psychosocial, I think, that we need to. Yes, absolutely.
So important. And so it's helping people in the clinical setting ask, how are you feeling about it?
Right.
You know, when you got the news, what was your response? And then using specific assessments to test for anxiety, to identify anxiety or depression, how to make referrals. These are all very important things. And again, more gaps in this space
that we need to find. Right. Because can I use the T? So we do T1D exchange.
Yeah.
So is that, you know, the depression screening tool that we're using right now, is that good enough? We have no idea.
Exactly.
Is it asking the right question for someone that doesn't treat their disease yet, even though they are antibody positive, right? So those things all need to come now.
Yes.
Right.
And so we will rely on our expert colleagues in behavioral health to present the evidence. They've presented the evidence they have. It's cited in the paper, but also to discover better ways to
do this. Exactly. Another tool, maybe a different tool for that.
Yes.
Antibody positive, yet not, you know, maybe even not even dysglycemic yet, right?
So yes.
Stage 1 versus stage 2 even might be a difference. You know, I don't know. What questions should be asked?
Those are also
really a lack of information, education, resources for that stage 1 T1D. And so and stage 2. So it seems like a lonely place to be, at least with stage 2. I mean, now there's at least a therapy. There's some type of option we can offer. But it just seems like a lonely place to be because there's not this big community like we have for the general, the stage 3 and T1D or people type 2. So it's just, I think we need to, kind of look at that a little bit more.
I love that, Diana. And that's something we're thinking a lot about at Breakthrough T1D.
Right.
You know,
so we're separate. What do we do?
I think it's different. You know, yep. As a kid with in stage 2 type 1 diabetes, go to diabetes camp. When they come to the walk, they're not using a pump.
Right.
Right. They're not. It's a different, and they have a different set of concerns. I have been very humbled to learn from our colleagues in behavioral health about, you know, risk perception and anxiety people feel. And, you know, I had my own children screen. So I have a personal connection to type 1 diabetes through my kids. And so I think that we have a lot to learn.
Right.
But we do need to create community. And we need a place where people can come. It's a lonely place. And people need a place where they can talk to each other.
Yep.
And share those experiences and have somebody to call or text or discuss with about how they're feeling about these things.
Right. There's a mom here and a mom here.
Yeah.
We cook these people up because it is, you know, we're looking at 64,000 diagnoses a year. It's not going to be that there's 10 people in a town that all have positive antibodies at one time, right? So it's going to be a more of a regional kind of support, I would guess, especially in the beginning as screening ramps up and we do, you know, those kinds of things. But I think we sometimes even have that as adults. you know, one of our favorite things about Breakthrough T1D is that it doesn't say juvenile anymore, right? It doesn't. And so that attracts the adults to say, no, no, this is where we go for information on type 1, no matter who you are,
yeah.
Right? This is where you go for information on antibody positive. You know, we are supporting you because legally, in our medical legal, you do have type 1 with 2 or more autoantibodies, right? You're stage 2, but you don't have the same, you know, you don't have the same behaviors every day that you need to do. You don't have to take insulin. You don't.
Right.
But we might put you on a CGM to see where if you're starting to rise or not. Are you dysglycemic yet? So it's going to be very interesting as to how to create that support and not fear of every day. Am I thirsty? Do I think I'm thirsty? Right? Right. You know, those kinds of fears.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot to learn. And I think there are people living in that space right now who are autoantibody positive, who are dysglycemic. Community is important. You can get a lot of support from the healthcare team, but it's like with any chronic diagnosis and like with type 1 diabetes, community is what gets you through.
Absolutely.
And that's going to be really important to develop for our community as we move in this direction. Absolutely.
This is so exciting.
It really, really is.
Yes. And
thank you so much. I know it's such a busy conference. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah.
And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers for tuning in. And that's a wrap from ADA Scientific Sessions. We will see you next time.